the worst location for a mounted archer to fire at without exposing his whole body. So Belisarius and his men simply grit their teeth, sheltered as best they could behind angled shields, and endured the Kushans' raking fire. The other Roman sally, on the other hand, the one which Agathias was leading from the southern portals, was in the ideal position for the mounted archers. As they came charging out, the Kushans were on their left front. Every one of those 1,000 cataphracts who pounded past the Kushan hedgehog fired at least one arrow into the enemy mass. At a range of 50 yards, full-drawn cataphract bows could send arrows through any kind of armor, even through iron-reinforced laminated wood shields, unless the shields were properly angled. The Kushan shield wall crumpled under that withering missile fire. Belisarius and his men on the opposite side were the immediate beneficiaries. The Kushans on the north left off their raking fire and hastened to shore up their bleeding ranks on the south. Now the Kushan vanguard was behind the Roman cavalry sally. Belisarius and his cataphracts were within 50 yards of the Malwa regulars who had been advancing behind the Kushans. Those troops, thousands of dismounted cavalrymen, suddenly broke into headlong flight. Caught between a completely unexpected flank attack and the mass sally of the Romans in the villa, their nerve collapsed. The still-mounted Yetai security guards tried to rally the fleeing soldiers, viciously sabering dozens of them as they ran past, but to no avail. Belisarius gave a quick glance over his shoulder. The Syrian cavalry, following the heavily armored Greeks, were already spreading wide and beginning to pull ahead of the slower cataphracts. They were staying well away from the Kushans. Their purpose was to ravage the flanks of the rapidly disintegrating main force of the enemy. Behind them, trotting out of the villa and taking up positions, came the Syrian infantry. They were concentrating in front of the villa itself and to the north, leaving the now isolated Kushans with a clear line of retreat toward the corrals. Satisfied, the general turned back. The Malwa soldier nearest to him, racing away, stumbled and fell. Belisarius didn't waste a lance thrust. He simply trampled the man under and kept going. A Yetai horseman came charging, his own lance held high. Belisarius braced in the stirrups and swept the Yetai off his saddle with a lance thrust which spilled open his intestines. Another Malwa regular ran away, his feet flashing like an antelope's. The general's lance took him between the shoulder blades. Belisarius killed three more soldiers in the same manner before he lost his lance stuck in a Malwa spine. He drew his long cavalry sword and continued the slaughter. The front ranks of the enemy were completely routed now. Even the Yetai had given up their efforts to rally the troops. The barbarians, still mounted, were outpacing all others in the retreat. The Malwa regulars had no thought in their minds but to outrun the Roman cavalry. They were not the first men in a battle to be seized by that panicky, hopeless notion, and they were not the first to suffer the penalty. The general never ceased from his ruthless work, leaving a trail of slashed corpses behind him. But the inner man almost flinched away from the horror until he found refuge, as he had so often before, in the cold workings of his intellect. "It's the worst mistake infantry ever makes," he thought. "If they stood their ground against a cavalry charge like the Kushans did, they'd have a chance. Now, nothing. Nothing." A sudden line of explosions nearby, almost directly to his left, broke through his grim thoughts. He saw out of the corner of an eye one of his cataphracts clutch his face with both hands and fall off his saddle. Another cataphract's horse tumbled, spilling his rider. Those were Katyusha rockets. God damn it, hold your fire! No luck. Belisarius could see another volley of rockets sailing toward them. The rockets, of course, had been intended for the Malwa, part of the plan to cave in the enemy's right flank. That was little comfort when several of those rockets overshot the enemy and wreaked havoc in his own ranks. Loudly and profanely, the general cursed Morris for a fool, and Basil, the Katyusha commander, for a moron sired by an imbecile. But Belisarius himself had instructed Morris to lead the charge with Katyushas. Knowing full well that even Roman rockets were not very accurate, the general had given the orders nonetheless. He had simply not expected the Malwa to cave in so quickly. He had assumed that the rocket volleys would be over and done with by the time the cataphracts arrived. So he cursed himself for an idiot. Rockets are an area effect weapon, you fucking jackass. Don't ever do this again. He pushed self-recrimination aside. He had almost reached the center of the Malwa army. Ahead of him, he could see Kshatriya and priests frantically trying to turn the wagons around. The mules hauling those wagons, true to their stubborn nature, were obeying their master's shrieking commands with mute recalcitrance. The sight almost made him laugh. What did the priests hope to accomplish? Mule-drawn wagons had no more chance of escaping a cavalry pursuit than did men on foot. One of the Mahavedas standing atop the nearest wagon apparently reached the same conclusion. Belisarius was only 20 yards away when he saw the priest's face stiffen with resolve. The man stooped, seized a small barrel of gunpowder, and spilled its contents over the barrel stacks. The priest was just drawing a lighting device out of his tunic when Belisarius's saber cut the legs out from under him. The priest sprawled across the barrels, still holding the striker. Belisarius's next slash removed that hand. His next, the Mahaveda's head. The general reined in his horse and clambered onto the wagon. From that perch he began bellowing orders in his thunderous battlefield voice. The orders were pungent, profane, simple, and quite unnecessary. Anastasius and Valentinian had already secured the two closest wagons. The Greek cataphracts, within 10 seconds, had done the same with the rest. All of the Kshatriya, still on the wagons, perhaps 50, tried to surrender, along with the remaining 24 priests. The cataphracts would have none of it. Many of those men had seen the first priest's suicidal attempt to blow up the ammunition cart. The Greeks slaughtered any Malwa among the wagons without mercy. Belisarius left off his bellowing. The deed was done. The Malwa wagons, with their great load of gunpowder, were safely in Roman hands. He clambered onto the highest placed barrel. From that precarious perch, he strained to see what he could of the battle. Battle no longer. The rout was complete. Morris's hammer blow had completely shattered the Malwa right. The Yetai who had guarded that flank had taken frightful casualties before breaking. Whatever their other characteristics, no one had ever accused Yetai of cowardice, so they had stood their ground almost to a man, Belisarius judged, estimating the mound of corpses. The courage had been useless, of course. Not even the best troops in Belisarius's experience could put up an effective defense against a surprise mass attack coming on their flank. Not on an open field of battle, at any rate, with no place to shelter and regroup. Such troops could fight bravely, but they would fight as confused individuals against a well-organized, steady, and determined attacker. The conclusion was foregone. It was equally obvious that the Malwa regulars had not come to the assistance of the barbarians. The Malwa regulars, clustered with the main force, had still been mounted, unlike their luckless comrades who had been advancing on foot behind the Kushan attack. They had seen no reason to abandon that good fortune, and had immediately taken flight away from the Roman flank attack. Good fortune. Fleeting fortune. In their natural desire to make the quickest escape from that frightening mass of oncoming Thracians, Illyrians, and Persians, heavy cavalry, all of them, shaking the very earth in their charge out of the northeast woods, the Malwa regulars had broken to the south. A mass rout. Thousands of horsemen galloping frantically around the edge of the forest into the Euphrates. As soon as they realized their error, of course, the fleeing Malwa began racing east down the riverbank toward the far distant refuge of the Malwa forces besieging Babylon. Few of those men would ever find that refuge 200 miles away. Very few. The men pursuing them were veterans, led by experienced and capable commanders. Morris and Carouche, seeing the direction of the Malwa retreat, had sent their cataphracts and Dagans angling southeast. They would cut off the Malwa escape, trap them against the river. Belisarius watched his Katyusha rocket chariots wheel into a line some 300 yards away. A small figure, their commander Basil, he assumed, although he couldn't recognize any faces at the distance, was prancing back and forth on his horse, issuing commands. A moment later, a volley of hissing rockets sailed toward the Euphrates. Belisarius watched their flight. It was his first opportunity to observe the rockets without the distraction of immediate battle. The missiles flew in a shallow trajectory with little of the erratic serpentine motion of Malwa rockets. Seconds later, the general saw the warheads erupt, scattering shrapnel through the milling mob of Malwa packed on the riverbank. The carnage was impressive. Belisarius had seen to it that Roman rockets carried well-designed shrapnel in their warheads. Lead dropshot, rather than the pebbles and other odds and ends which Malwa rockets used. Belisarius now looked toward the villa. Here, too, he saw the situation was progressing nicely. Those Malwa infantrymen who had managed to escape the sally were also pouring toward the river. The Syrian cavalry had peeled off from the captured powder wagons and were driving the Malwa toward the north bank of the Euphrates. Behind them, the Syrian infantry had taken formations opposite the Kushans. The Kushans were already withdrawing toward the corrals. The Syrians followed at a respectful distance, content to let them go. He heard Agathias's voice raised in a cheerful hail. Turning, Belisarius saw Agathias and several of his cataphracts trotting toward him. "I sent most of my men to help the Syrians," he announced, "after I saw you doing the same." Belisarius hadn't actually given that order. There had been no need, since Cyril had done so without any prompting, and the general had wanted to concentrate his attention on watching Morris's half of the battle. But now, looking around, he saw that there were only 100 or so cataphracts left guarding the wagons. Belisarius was immensely pleased. Immensely. There were few things the general treasured more than quick-thinking and self-reliant subordinates. He was firmly convinced that at least half his success as a commander was due to his ability to gather such men around him. Men like Morris, Ashot, Hermogenes, John of Rhodes, even Boozies and Cootsies once he'd knocked the crap out of them. And now men like Agathias and Cyril. Something of his delight must have shown. A moment later, he and his two new Greek officers were beaming at each other. There was nothing at all crooked in the general's grin now, and not a trace of veteran sardonicism in those of Agathias and Cyril. "Jesus, General," exclaimed Agathias, "this is the sweetest damn battle I ever saw."
"Beautiful, beautiful," agreed Cyril. "Only fuck-up was that one rocket volley."
Belisarius grimaced. "My fault, that. I should have remembered the damn things still aren't that accurate, and I wasn't expecting we'd get so close this quickly." Cyril didn't seem in the slightest aggrieved, even though it was his men who had suffered from that friendly fire. The Greek cataphract simply shrugged and pronounced the oldest of all veteran wisdom.
"Shit happens."
Agathias nodded his agreement. "Live and learn, that's all you can do. Besides," he twisted in his saddle, studying the effect of the current rocket volleys on the Malwa massed by the river.
"They're doing fine work now. Save a lot of Roman boys, the Katyushas will, by the time they're done. Those Malwa shits will be like stunned sheep."
Belisarius heard another hail. Turning, he saw that Morris was approaching from the north. The Kiliarch was accompanied by one of his hecatontarchs, Gregory, and a half-dozen cataphracts. When Morris drew up alongside the wagon, his first words were to Cyril and Agathias.
"Sorry about the rockets," he stated.
His voice was firm and level, very courteous in tone, although the expression on his face seemed more one of embarrassment than remorse. Morris now looked to Belisarius.
"Don't even bother asking," he growled. "The answer's no. My boys would probably be willing enough, even if those raggedy-ass Malwa fucks couldn't come up with the two solid as ransom amongst them. But the Persians are completely berserk, and there's no way to stop them without—"
Belisarius shook his head.
"I know. I can hear their battle cries."
He cocked his ear, listening. Even at the distance, the Persian voices were quite distinct.
"Karax! Karax! Death to Malwa! No quarter!"
Seeing the look of confusion on the faces of Agathias and Cyril, Morris chuckled.
"The young general here," he pointed a thumb at Belisarius, "has a soft and tender heart. Likes to avoid atrocities when he can."
The two Greek officers eyed the general uncertainly, much as men gaze upon someone pronounced to be a living saint. Possible, but more likely just a babbling madman. Then, remembering his savage punishment of the 8 cataphracts at Callinicum, uncertainty fled. Agathias winced.
Mother of God, General Morris is right. There's no wait.
Again, Belisarius shook his head, smiling crookedly. I'm not asking, Agathias. The Persians won't be stopped, not after Carax. I'm quite aware of that. The smile faded, replaced by a look of scrutiny. But I'll ask you to remember this day in the future, the very near future, in fact, when the Persians demand the heads of 2,000 Kushans, and I refuse. He pointed toward the river. Atrocities produce this kind of massacre. That's one of the reasons I try to avoid them. You might be on the other end the next time, pleading for mercy and not getting it because you showed none yourself.
Wouldn't get it from the Malwa anyway, pointed out Morris.
He spoke mildly, as usual, when he was contradicting Belisarius in public, but firmly. From Malwa, no, replied the general. But what is Malwa, Morris? He nodded toward the river. You think those men are all Malwa, or Yetai? Precious few of them, in truth. The priests and Kshatriyas, most of the officers, perhaps 1,000 of the regulars. The rest? Biharis, Bengalis, Orissans. Every subject nation of India is spilling its lifeblood into that river. He transferred his scrutiny to Agathias and Cyril. In the end, Belisarius told them, his voice as hard as steel, we will not defeat Malwa on a great field of battle somewhere here in Persia, or in Anatolia, or Bactria, or in the Indus Plain. We will shatter them in the heart of India itself, when their subjects finally throw off the yoke. Uncertainty returned to the faces of the two Greeks. Now, however, it wasn't the bemused skepticism of men regarding a proclaimed saint. It was the simple doubt, the veteran questioning, of fighting men who were beginning to wonder if their commander might, after all, be that rarest of generals, a supreme strategist, as well as a wizard on the battlefield. I would spare all of them who tried to surrender, if I could, mused Belisarius. All, at least, except the Mahaveda priests. For the sake of the future, if nothing else. He shrugged heavily. But I can't risk an idiot brawl with the Persians. Not today, when their blood's aboil. He clambered off the barrel. A moment later, he was back astride his horse. Today, I can only deal with the Kushans. He pointed to the river. Agathias, Cyril, I want you to give full support to the Persians. Back them to the hilt. As maddened as they are, they won't be thinking clearly. There are still thousands of live and armed enemy troops packed against the river. They'll fight like cornered rats once they realize surrender's not being offered. The Persians are likely to wade into them without thinking, get surrounded. Agathias and Cyril nodded. Take all your men, Belisarius added, except 100 or so to guard over the wagons. Have those men bring the wagons back to the villa, but be careful. In fact, better wait until you have some of the Katyusha men to help. They're more familiar with handling gunpowder. The two Greek officers nodded again. They turned their horses and trotted off, shouting commands. Within a few seconds, 2,000 Constantinople cataphracts were thundering toward the river, preparing to throw their weight into the butchery on the Euphrates. Belisarius turned to Morris and Gregory. You do the same, Morris, with the Thracians and the Illyrians. Gregory, I want you to find Kutsis and Abu, he added, chuckling, if he managed to find a new horse. Get the Arab skirmishers and half the light cavalry across the river. Leave me the other half to keep the Kushans cornered.
They'll have to use the ford we found a few miles upstream, remarked Gregory. That'll lose us several hours.
Yes, I know. It doesn't matter. They'll still be in time to harry whatever Malwa make their way across the Euphrates. His face and voice were cold, grim, ruthless.
Harry them, Gregory. I want them pursued without mercy. For days, if that's what it takes. I want this Malwa army destroyed. Not more than a handful of survivors trickling back to their lines in Babylon. Let the enemy know he can't hope to go around Emperor Khusrow.
Gregory's face twisted into his own crooked smile.
Might not even be a handful, General. Those few that get away from us will still have 200 miles to go. With the desert on one side and on the other, every peasant in the floodplain ready to hack them down. Whole villages will turn out to join the pursuit. They've heard about Carax, too, you can bet on it.
Belisarius nodded. Gregory spurred his horse, heading south. A moment later, going in the opposite direction, Morris did the same. Only Valentinian and Anastasius were left in the immediate vicinity.
"What now, General?" asked Anastasius.
Belisarius clucked his horse into motion, trotting back toward the villa. "We'll make sure the Kushans are completely boxed in." After that, he looked up, gauging the sun. "That'll probably take the rest of the day, till late afternoon, for sure. The Kushans may try to break out. We've probably still got some fighting ahead of us."
"Not much," rumbled Anastasius. "The Kushans are no fools. They won't waste much effort trying to find an escape route. Not on foot, knowing we've got cavalry."
The giant sighed.
"Not Kushans. They'll be working like beavers instead, doing what they can to turn the barns and corrals into a fortress, ready to bleed us when we come in after them tomorrow."
"I hope to avoid that problem," said Belisarius.
"You think you can talk them into surrendering?" asked Valentinian skeptically. "After they'll have spent half a day listening to the rest of their army being massacred?"
"That's my plan." Oddly, the general's voice lost none of its confident good cheer. Neither did Valentinian's its skepticism.
"Be like walking into a lion's den, trying to talk them out of their meat."
"Not so hard, that," replied Belisarius. "Not at least if you can speak lion." He eyed Valentinian, smiled crookedly. "I speak Kushan fluently, you know." The smile grew very crooked. Anastasia scowled. Valentinian hissed.
"Now that I think about it, both of you speak Kushan too. Not as well as I do, perhaps, but well enough. Well enough."
He cocked his ear toward Valentinian.
"What? No muttering?"
The cataphract eyed Belisarius with a weasel's glare.
"Words fail me," he muttered.
That evening, just as the sun was setting on the horizon, Belisarius approached the fort at Kushans for a parley. He was unarmed, accompanied only by Valentinian and Anastasius. Anastasius also was unarmed. Valentinian, well, he swore the same. Swore it on all the saints in his mother's grave. Belisarius didn't believe him, not for a minute, but he didn't push the matter. Whatever weapons Valentinian carried would be well hidden. And besides, he'd rather try to talk lions into surrendering than talk a weasel out of its teeth. An entirely safer proposition. In the end, talking the Kushan lions out of their determination to fight to the last man proved to be one of the easiest things the general had ever done, and the doing of it brought him great satisfaction. Once again, a reputation proved worth its weight in gold. Not a reputation for mercy this time. Kushans had seen precious little of mercy in their harsh lives and would have disbelieved any such tales of a foreign general. And as it turned out, they were quite familiar with the name of Belisarius. It was a name of honor, their commander had been told, by one of the few men not of Kushan blood that he trusted.
"Manasanga told me himself," the man stated.
He drew himself up proudly. "I visited Rajputana's greatest king in his palace at his own invitation before he left with Lord Demodara for the Hindu Kush." The man leaned over, pouring a small libation into Belisarius's drinking cup before doing the same in the one before him. The vessels were plain, utilitarian pieces of pottery, like the bottle from which the wine was poured. After Belisarius had taken his seat, sitting cross-legged like his Kushan counterpart on a thin layer of straw spread in a corner of the stable, the Kushan soldiers gathered around had produced the jug and two cups out of a field kit. Belisarius took advantage of the momentary pause to study the Kushan commander more closely. The man's name, he had already learned, was Vasudeva. In appearance, Vasudeva was much like any other Kushan soldier. Short, stocky, thick-chested, sturdy legs and shoulders. His complexion had a yellowish Asiatic cast, as did his flat nose and narrow eyes. Like most Kushans, the man's hair was drawn up into a topknot. His beard was more in the way of a goatee than the thicker cut favored by Romans or Persians, and like most Kushans, his face seemed carved from stone. His expression, almost impossible to read. The Kushan Belisarius knew best,
the former Malwa vassal named Kungus, who was now commander of Empress Shakuntala's personal bodyguard, had had a face so hard it had been like a mask. An iron mask, but a mask nonetheless, disguising a very different soul. Remembering Kungus, Belisarius felt his confidence growing. "And how was Ranasanga when you saw him?" he asked politely. The Kushan shrugged. "Who is to know what that man feels? His wife, perhaps his children, no others. Do you know why he asked you to visit him?" Vasudeva gave Belisarius a long, lingering look, a cold look at first. Then the look didn't warm so much as it grew merry, in a wintry sort of way. "Yes, we had met before during the war against Andhra, worked well together. When he heard that I had been selected one of the Kushan commanders for the Mesopotamian campaign, he called me to visit before his own departure." The Kushan barked a laugh. "He wanted to warn me about a Roman general named Belisarius." Vasudeva's eyes lost their focus for a moment as he remembered the conversation. "Persians you know, of course," Lord Sangha told me, "but you have never encountered Romans, certainly not such a Roman as Belisarius." The Kushan commander's eyes refocused, fixed on Belisarius. "He told me you were as tricky and quick as a mongoose." Another barking laugh. "Expect only the unexpected from that man," he said. "He adores feints and traps. If he makes an obvious threat, look for the blow to come from elsewhere. If he seems weak, be sure he's strong. Most of all, remember the fate of the arrogant cobra faced with a mongoose." He laughed again. All the Kushan soldiers standing around shared in that bitter laugh. "I tried to tell Lord Kumara when I realized we were facing Roman troops. I was almost sure you would be in command. Lord Kumara was the commander of this expedition." "Lord Fishbait now," snarled one of the other Kushans. "And good riddance." Vasudeva scowled. Of course, he refused to listen, fell right into the trap. Belisarius took a sip from his cup. "And what else did Ranasanga say about me?" Again, Vasudeva gave Belisarius that long, lingering look, still cold, gauging, assessing. "He said that one thing only is predictable about the man Belisarius. He will be a man of honor. He too knows the meaning of vows." Belisarius waited. Vasudeva tugged the point of his goatee with his fingers, looked away. "It's difficult. Difficult," he murmured. Belisarius waited. Vasudeva sighed. "We will not be broken up, sold as slaves to whichever bidder. We must be kept together." Belisarius nodded. "Agreed. Any labor will be acceptable except the work of menials. Kushan soldiers are not domestic dogs." Belisarius nodded. "Agreed. No whippings, no beatings of any kind. Execution will be acceptable in cases of disobedience, but it must be by the sword or the axe. We are not criminals to be hung or impaled." Belisarius nodded. "Agreed. Decent food, a bit of wine now and again." Belisarius shook his head. "That I cannot promise. I'm on campaign myself and will be using you for a labor force. My own men may eat poorly at times and go without wine. I can only promise that you will eat no worse than they do, and enjoy some wine if there is any to spare." From the little murmur which came from the surrounding soldiers, the general knew that his forthright answer had pleased them. He suspected, although he wasn't sure, that the last question had been Vasudeva's own little trap. The Kushan commander was obviously a seasoned veteran. He would have known full well that any other answer would be either a lie or the words of a cocksure and foolhardy man. "Agreed," said Vasudeva. Belisarius waited. Finally, the word came. "Swear." Belisarius gave his oath. Gave it twice, in fact. Once in the name of his own Christian god, and then, to the Kushan's great surprise, on the name of the Buddha, to whom they swore in private, when there were no Mahaveda priests to hear the heresy.
That evening, late at night, Belisarius began his negotiations with the Persians, seated now amidst the splendid wreckage of what had once been an emperor's favorite hunting villa. Here, too, he found the task much easier than anticipated. Kurush, in the event, was not baying for Kushan blood. After the young Sauteron heard what Belisarius had to say, he simply poured himself some wine. A noble vintage, this, poured from a Sauteron's jug into a Sauteron's gorgeous goblet. He drank half the goblet in one gulp, then said, "All right." Belisarius eyed him. Kurush scowled. "I'm not saying I like it," he grumbled, "but you gave your word. We Aryans, you know, understand the meaning of vows." He emptied the goblet in another single gulp. Then he gestured toward his blood-soaked garments and armor. "Karrax has been well enough avenged for one day." "Growl, I suppose." Belisarius let it be. He saw no reason to press Kurush for anything beyond his grudging acceptance. He did cast a questioning glance at Beresmenus. The older Sauteron had said nothing thus far, and it was obvious that he intended to maintain his silence. He simply returned Belisarius's gaze with his own fair imitation of a mask. No, Beresmenus would say nothing. But Belisarius suspected that the Persian nobleman had already had his say, earlier to his young and vigorous nephew, reminding him of a Roman general's mercy at a place called Minduis, and teaching him, or trying at least, that mercy can have its own sharp point, keener than any lance or blade, and even deadlier to the foe.
Chapter 21. The Malabar Coast. Summer 531 AD. The refugee camps in Musiris swarmed like anthills. Families gathered up their few belongings and awaited the voyage to the island of Tamrapurni. Maratha cavalrymen and Kushan soldiers readied their gear. The great fleet of ships assembling in the harbor cleared their holds. Carolan officials presented chests full of gold and silver to fund the migration. An empress and her advisors schemed. And old friends arrived. In mid-afternoon of a sunny day, a rarity that in southwest India during the monsoon season, five Aksumite warships entered the harbor at Musiris. They weren't hailed by Carolan guard vessels. There was no pretense any longer that the port of Musiris was under anyone's control but Shakuntala's. The Ethiopian vessels were met by a warship requisitioned from Kerala, but manned by Maratha sailors. Once their identity was established, the Ethiopians were immediately escorted into the presence of the Empress. There were 400 of the Aksumite soldiers along with four other men. Shakuntala, forewarned, greeted them with a full imperial ceremony before the great mansion she had taken for her palace. The three Ethiopians who led that march were deeply impressed by what they saw, as were the four men walking with them who were not African. The seven men at the front were familiar with India and with Shakuntala's situation. They had been expecting something patchwork and ragged. A rebel empress, a hunted young girl hiding in a precarious refuge, with nothing but the handful of Kushan soldiers who had spirited her out of the Malwa Empire. Instead, the street down which they were escorted by hundreds of Maratha cavalrymen was lined with thousands of cheering people. Most were refugees from Andhra and other Malwa-conquered lands of India, but there were many dark-skinned Carolans among that crowd as well. Her own grandfather might have disowned her, and Malwa provocateurs might have stirred up much animosity toward the refugees who had poured into the kingdom, but many of her mother's people hadn't forgotten that Shakuntala was a daughter of Kerala herself. So they too cheered, and loudly, at this further evidence that the Empress in exile of Andhra was a force to be reckoned with. Allies from far-off Africa, and such splendid-looking soldiers, which indeed they were. The Sarwen rose to the occasion, abandoning their usual Aksumite informality. In stiff lines they marched, their great spears held high, ostrich plume headdresses bobbing proudly. As they approached the Empress's palace, kettledrums began beating. At the steps leading up to the palace doors, the march halted. The doors swung wide, and dozens, then hundreds of Kushan soldiers trotted out and took positions on the palace steps. The last Kushans to emerge were Shakuntala's personal bodyguard,
the small band of men who had been with her since she inherited her throne. Since the very day, in fact. For these were the men who had taken her out of her father's palace in Amaravati on the day her family was slaughtered as a Malwa captive. And then, months later, had spit in Malwa's face and taken her to freedom. Finally, Shakuntala herself emerged, with Dadaji Holkar at her side. Four imperial ladies-in-waiting came behind them. She stepped, say better, pranced, down the stairs to greet her visitors. For all the pomp and splendor, the dignity of the occasion was threadbare. Genuine joy has a way of undermining formality. Among the Ethiopians who stood before the palace were four Kushans, the squad led by Kujulo, who had assisted Prince Aeon in his escape from India the year before. As soon as Shakuntala's bodyguards spotted their long-lost brethren, their discipline frayed considerably. They didn't break formation, of course, but the grins on their faces went poorly with the solemnity of the occasion. It hardly mattered, since their own empress was grinning just as widely, partly at the sight of Kujulo and his men, mostly at the familiar faces of the three Ethiopians at the front, Garmat, Ezana, and Wasi, three of that small band of men who had rescued her from Malwa captivity. Seeing an absent face, her grin faded. Garmat shook his head. No, Shakuntala, he did not come with us. The Nagusinagast sent Aeon on a different mission, but the prince asked me to convey his greetings and his best wishes. Shakuntala nodded. We will speak of it later. For the moment, let me thank you for returning my Kushan bodyguards. Smiling, she turned and beckoned one of her ladies-in-waiting forward. And I have no doubt you will want to take Tarabai back with you, as I promised Aeon. The Maratha woman stepped forward. Although she was trying to maintain her composure, Tarabai's expression was a jumbled combination of happiness and anxiety. Happiness at the prospect of being reunited with her prince, anxiety that he might have lost interest in her after their long separation. During the course of Prince Aeon's adventures in India the year before, he and Tarabai had become almost inseparable. Before they went their separate ways in escaping the Malwa, Aeon had asked her to become his concubine, and she had accepted. That was then, and princes are notoriously fickle and short of memory. Garmat immediately allayed her anxiety. Aeon may not be in Aksum upon your arrival, Tarabai. He is occupied elsewhere at the moment, but he hopes you have not changed your mind. The old half-Arab smiled. Actually, he does more than hope. He is already adding a wing to his palace, your quarters when you arrive, as well as those of your children when they arrive, as I'm sure they will, soon enough. Tarabai blushed, beamed. That business done, Garmat's gaze returned to the Empress. His smile faded. So much is pleasure, Your Majesty. Now for the rest. He straightened, then in a loud voice, I bring you an official offer of alliance from the Nagusinagast of Aksum, a full alliance against the Malwa. A buzz of whispered conversation filled the air at this announcement. We heard upon your arrival that you plan to transport your people to the island of Ceylon. Let me make clear that if you desire, you and your people may seek refuge in Ethiopia instead. Shakuntala would have sworn that her expression never changed, but she had forgotten Garmat's uncanny shrewdness. Ah, he murmured. His voice was soft and pitched low. So low that only she and Dadaji could now hear him. I had wondered. Exile to a distant land didn't really seem in your nature, so I have five ships, Your Majesty. On board those ships came half of the Takuan Sawe, 400 soldiers under the command of Ezana and Wasi. One of those ships must convey Tarabai and myself back to Ethiopia. The rest, including all of the Sawen, are at your disposal. Shakuntala nodded. She, too, spoke softly. More ships, I believe? Garmat's smile returned. Aksumite warships, Empress, he coughed modestly. Rather superior, don't you know, to those Malwa tubs. And I dare say our Sarwen could handle three times their number of Malwa's so-called marines. Yes, I know, she replied. As it happens, I can use them. The ships and the Sarwen both. Have you heard the news of Deagiri? Garmat nodded. His smile widened. She leaned forward.
as it happens.
3 days later, in a pouring rain, the fleet left Muziris. The Matsusacheva Ganapati and the city's viceroy stood watching from the docks. All day they remained there, sheltered from the downpour under a small pavilion, until they were certain that every single one of the cursed Empress in Exile's followers had quit Carolyn's soil. Not until the last ship disappeared into the rain did they summon their howdah.
"Thank the gods," muttered the viceroy.
Ganapati's expression was sour.
"For what?" he demanded. "The damage may already have been done. A courier arrived this morning from Vanji. The Malwa have been issuing the most pointed and severe threats. They are demanding that the king arrest Shakuntala and return her to captivity."
The viceroy shook his head.
"He can hardly expect the king to do that. She is his granddaughter, after all."
"Probably not," agreed Ganapati. He shrugged.
"Hopefully they will be satisfied with the fact that we have expelled her and her followers from Carolyn's soil. I will immediately dispatch a courier with the news."
The elephant bearing the howdah loomed up in the rain. Hurriedly, the two Carolyn officials scrambled aboard the great beast. Despite their haste, they were soaked through by the time they reached the shelter of the howdah. Ganapati's expression was still sour.
"Cursed monsoon," he muttered.
A sudden freakish gust blew aside a curtain and drenched his companion.
"Cursed monsoon," cried the viceroy.
"Blessed monsoon," stated Kungus cheerfully.
The commander of Shakuntala's bodyguard leaned over the rail of the ship and admired the view. He didn't seem in the slightest aggrieved by the fact that he was soaking wet, or that there was no view to be admired. Neither did the man standing next to him.
"Blessed monsoon," agreed Dadaji Holker. "No one will be able to see which direction we take. Let's just hope that the rain keeps up."
"This time of year?" demanded Kungus, chuckling. "Be serious, Dadaji. Look!"
He pointed eastward. Their ship was not more than 2 miles from the shore, but the coast of Malabar was completely invisible.
"Can't see a thing," he pronounced.
"It'll be that way 9 days out of 10, for at least another month. More than long enough for us to reach Supara, even with this slow fleet."
Dadaji began to stroke his beard, but quickly left off the familiar gesture. It was a bit too much like wringing a sponge.
"True," he murmured. "And there is the additional advantage as well. The refugees won't know where we're going either. Most of them will continue to think we're heading for Tamrapurni until the very day we sail into Supara."
Kungus cast him a sidelong glance.
"Might be a bit of trouble, then."
Dadaji shook his head.
"I don't think so. I had many spies in the camps, and they all reported that the great majority of the refugees are devoted to the Empress. I believe they will accept her decision. Besides, she intends to offer those who don't want to return to Maharashtra the alternative of Tamrapurni. Whichever so choose, she will provide them with the necessary ships to make the voyage. After we've seized Supara, of course."
A thin smile cracked Kungus's face.
"Not much of an alternative, that. The king of Tamrapurni is not going to be pleased when he hears how Shakuntala used his name in vain. His own son in marriage, no less."
Holker made no reply. For a few minutes, the two men simply stared out at nothing. Nothing but beautiful, blinding, concealing sheets of rain. Eventually, Kungus cleared his throat.
"Speaking of marriage," he stated.
Holker grimaced.
"She refuses to even discuss it," he said softly. "Believe me, my friend, I have tried to broach the subject on many occasions. Each time she says the question is premature."
Kungus twitched his shoulders.
"That's not the point. For her to marry anyone now would be premature. She has nothing to offer at the moment in exchange for an alliance with real forces. But after we take Supara, after we demonstrate to India and all the world that Andhra intends to hold southern Maharashtra, then the question of a dynastic marriage will pose itself. She must start thinking about it, Dadaji, or else she will be paralyzed when the time comes."
The Empress's advisor sighed.
"You know the problem, my friend."
Kungus stared out to sea. Nodded once, twice.
She is in love with Rao.
Hoker blew out his cheeks.
Please, he growled. It is the infatuation of a young girl with a man she knew only as a child. She hasn't seen him hardly at all in 2 years.
She has seen him for a few hours only during that time, agreed Kungus.
His voice rumbled like stones.
After he gutted the Vile One's palace in order to rescue her.
Quite a reunion that must have been.
Hoker said nothing. Kungus turned his head away as if something had caught his eye. In truth, he simply didn't want Hoker to see his face. Not even Kungus at that moment could keep from smiling.
Excellent. The thought was full of satisfaction. Excellent child. Poor Hoker. Even he is blind on this point.
For a moment, as he had many times before, Kungus found himself bemused by that peculiarly Indian obsession with purity and pollution. Even his friend Dadaji couldn't entirely escape its clutches.
So blind, these Indians,
and the truth is so obvious.
He turned away from the rail.
Enough rain, he announced. I'm going below. The action's going to start soon anyway. I have to get ready
in case I'm needed.
As he walked across the deck toward the hatch, Kungus's face was invisible to anyone. Now, finally, he allowed his grin to emerge.
Stay stubborn, Shakuntala.
Dig in your heels, girl. Refuse to discuss it. When the question of marriage is finally posed, you will know what to do.
Then you will know.
He shook his head slightly.
So obvious.
An hour later, the fleet changed its course. The change was slow, erratic, confused, haphazard. Part of that fumbling was due to the simple fact that the troop commanders on every ship had a different estimate of the right moment to give the command. The only timekeeping devices available to them were hourglasses and sundials. Sundials were useless in the pouring monsoon. Hourglasses, under these circumstances, just as much so. It would have been impossible to provide each commander with an identical hourglass, much less have them turned over simultaneously. So each commander simply gave the order when he thought the time was right. Most of the confusion, however, was due to the fact that the crews and captains of the merchant ships were bitterly opposed to the change of course. They had been hired to transport the Empress and her people to Tamrapurni. They were not, to put it mildly, pleased to hear that the destination had been changed, especially when they discovered the new one.
Supara? Are you mad? The Malwa hold Supara!
But the captains of the ships were not the commanders. The commanders were a very different breed altogether. Kushans and Maratha cavalrymen in the main, who cheerfully accepted the berating abuse of the Carolan ship captains. For about 1 minute. Then the steel was drawn. Thereafter, Carolan captains and seamen scurried about their newfound task. Grumbling, to be sure, but they had no illusions that they could overpower the squads of soldiers placed on each ship.
Not those soldiers.
One crew tried. Led by a particularly belligerent captain, the Carolan seamen dug out their own weapons and launched a mutiny. They outnumbered the soldiers 2-1, after all. Perhaps they thought their numbers would make the difference. They were sadly mistaken. Within 2 minutes, the 4 surviving seamen were huddled in the bow, nursing their wounds and casting fearful glances at the Kushan soldiers standing guard over them. Not one of those Kushans had even been scratched in the melee. And, to add to their misery, they saw the prow of a ship looming out of the downpour. Within seconds, the ship had drawn alongside. The Carolan seamen recognized the craft, one of those swift, fearsome Ethiopian warships. An Axumite officer leaned over the rail.
"Is problem?" he called out. "We hear noise of...
He faltered, having reached the limit of his skill with Hindi. The Kushan commander glared.
"Yes, there's a problem," he grated, pointing an accusing finger at the 4 captives.
The Carolan seamen hunched lower.
"There's only 4 of the bastards left, not enough to run the ship."
Another Ethiopian came to the rail. The Kushan commander immediately recognized him. Azana, one of the Axumite soldiers' top leaders. Azana gave the situation a quick scrutiny. He was familiar with Kushans and knew that they were not a seagoing folk. No hope they could run the ship themselves.
He turned his head and barked out a quick string of names. Within a minute, 6 Ethiopian soldiers were standing next to him. While they were mustering, Ezana took the opportunity to close with the merchant vessel. It was the work of but seconds for the Ethiopians to tie up alongside. Lightly, Ezana sprang across onto the Carolyn ship. He strode toward the bow where the Kushan commander was waiting, along with his men and the captives. Once there, Ezana made a little gesture at the 6 Axumites who were making their own way across. "These men will stay with you for the duration of the trip," he explained, speaking in heavily accented but quite good Hindi. "Along with the 4 surviving mutineers, that should be enough." He gave the ship a quick examination. Judging from his expression, he wasn't pleased with what he saw. "Indian tub," he sneered. "Can run a good Axumite trader with 6 men. 5, even 4 in an emergency." He transferred the sarcastic expression onto the 4 Carolyn survivors. The seamen hunched lower still, dropping their heads, doing everything in their power to fade out of sight. No use. Ezana squatted down next to them. "Look at me," he commanded. Reluctantly, they raised their heads. Ezana grinned. "Don't look so unhappy, lads. Consider your good fortune. My men hate running crappy ships like this. I'd have my own mutiny if I pitched you overboard and appointed 4 replacements." Hearing this happy news, the expression on the faces of the Carolyns brightened. A bit, no more, and that little bit immediately vanished under Ezana's ensuing scowl. "But they don't hate it as much as they hate mutineers," he rumbled. "I'd be on my best behavior from now on, if I were you." 4 Carolyn heads bobbed frantic agreement. Ezana's scowl deepened. "You're seamen, so I assume you're familiar with the Ethiopian treatment for mutineers." 4 Carolyn heads bobbed horrified agreement. "Good," he grunted. He rose and turned to the Kushan commander. "You won't have any more trouble," he pronounced. As he made his way back to the rail, the Kushan accompanied him. "What is the Ethiopian way with mutineers?" he asked. Ezana climbed onto the rail. Just before making his leap, he bestowed a cheerful grin onto the Kushan commander. "It involves fishing." He sprang across, turned, and called back. "We're partial to shark meat." 2 days later, Ezana came aboard the Empress's flagship. A council had been called for all the central leaders of the expedition. He, along with Wasi and Garmat, were to be the Ethiopian representatives at the meeting. Garmat was already aboard, waiting for him. As the 2 men fought their way across the deck in the face of a rain so heavy it seemed almost like a waterfall, Ezana grumbled, "This has got to be the worst climate in the world." Garmat smiled. "Oh, I don't know. At least it's not hot. The temperature's rather pleasant, actually. But as the empty quarter..." Ezana shook his head firmly. "No contest. At least you can breathe in Arabia." He cast a fierce glower at the heavy sky. "How much does it rain here, anyway?" They were at the small shed which provided an entryway into the large cabin amidship. Both men made an effort to wring out their clothes, mere kilts, fortunately, before entering. Garmat frowned in thought. "I'm not sure, actually. I think I heard somewhere that southwest India during the monsoon season gets..." He gave a figure in the Ethiopian way of measuring such things. Ezana's eyes widened. The figure was the equivalent of 13 feet of water in 5 months.
"Mother of God."
Garmat nodded toward the east, toward the invisible coast of India.
"Cheer up. If all goes well, soon enough we'll be crossing the mountains into Maharashtra. It's dry, I hear, on that side of the Western Ghats."
"Can't be soon enough," grumbled Ezana. He led the way into the cabin. The cabin, which served as Shakuntala's imperial quarters, was a bit grotesque to Ezana's eyes. He was an Ethiopian, brought up in the Axumite traditions of royal regalia. Those traditions leaned toward a style of ornamentation which was massive but austere, and always practical. When traveling by sea, an Ethiopian royal, even the Negusan Agast himself, would enjoy nothing more than a simple cabin decorated with, at most, a lion skin or ostrich feathers. The Indian tradition was otherwise.
Massive also, at times, Ezana had seen and been impressed by the size of the Malwa Emperor's palaces and pavilions, but not austere, not practical. Never seen so many gewgaws in my life, he thought sourly. His eye fell on an ivory carving perched atop a slender table by the entrance. The carving, incredibly ornate and intricate, depicted a half-naked couple entwined in a passionate embrace. Ezana almost winced. It wasn't the eroticism of the carving which offended him. Axumites weren't prudes. But the simple absurdity of the thing. On a warship? First storm, that thing's so much ballast. Garmak pushed him forward into the cabin.
We're diplomats, he whispered. Be polite.
Shakuntala was perched on a pile of cushions against the far wall of the cabin. Dadaji Holkar sat to her left in the position of her chief advisor. Next to him sat the religious leader Bindusara. Shakuntala's military commanders were clustered to her right. Kungus was there, along with his two chief Kushan subordinates, Kanishka and Kujulo. The Maratha cavalry leaders, Shaji and Kondev, were accompanied by three of their own top aides. Masi also was there. He had arrived earlier. He was perched on a little wooden stool. Two other stools rested nearby. The emperors had provided them, knowing the Ethiopian preference in seating. All of the Indians were squatting on cushions in the lotus position. Once Garmat and Ezana took their seats, Shakuntala spoke. The first stage of our strategy has been a resounding success. We have broken free from Kerala and eluded the Malwa. It is well nigh certain that our enemy believes we are headed for exile in Tamrapurni. She paused, scanning the room for any sign of dissent or disagreement. Seeing none, she continued. I believe we can assume that our arrival at Supara will come as a complete surprise for the enemy. That being so, it is now possible for us to concentrate our attention on the more distant future. We will surprise the Malwa at Supara, and we will take the city. The question is, then what?
Kondev stirred. Shakuntala turned toward him, cocking her head inquiringly. The gesture was an invitation to speak.
For a moment, the Maratha officer hesitated. He was a relatively new member of the Empress's inner circle. Accustomed to Indian traditions, he had been a top officer of Shakuntala's father, whose haughty imperial manner had been legendary. He was still nonplussed by her relaxed and easy manner with her advisors. Recognizing his uncertainty, Shakuntala prompted him.
Please, Kondev, speak up if you have some doubt.
The cavalry officer tugged at his beard nervously.
I don't have doubts, Your Majesty. Not precisely. But I thought our course of action after seizing Supara was simply to march on to Dehagiri, join our forces with Rao's.
He ducked his head in a quick, apologetic manner.
Perhaps I misunderstood.
You did not misunderstand, Kondev, replied Shakuntala.
That was our plan. But the unexpected arrival of the Axumites and their offer of an alliance has led me to reconsider, or at least to think in more ambitious terms.
She turned toward the Ethiopians. If we held Supara permanently, I mean, could your navy hold off the Malwa fleet?
The three Ethiopians exchanged quick glances. Masi was the first to speak.
No, Empress, he said firmly. If the Malwa didn't possess their gunpowder weapons, it might be possible. Their navy is much larger than ours, in men and ships, but ours is better. Besides, most of their fleet is tied up in the Persian invasion. He shrugged. The fact is, however, that they do possess the demon weapons. That nullifies our advantage of superior skill. We cannot close with them to board. Their rockets are erratic at long range, but they are fearsome weapons against a nearby enemy.
Shakuntala nodded. She didn't seem particularly chagrined or surprised by Wasi's reply.
You couldn't break a Malwa blockade of Supara, then?
Wasi shook his head.
Shakuntala leaned forward. Tell me this, Wasi. If we were able to hold Supara, keep the Malwa from recapturing the city, could you run the blockade?
All three Axumites burst into laughter.
Me like stealing chickens from a cripple, chuckled Ezana.
A very strong cripple, qualified Garmat. Have to be a bit careful. Still,
Wasi had stopped laughing.
Yes, Empress, he stated firmly. We could run the blockade. Penetrate it like water through a fishnet, in fact. Not one or two ships now and then,
We could run a Malwa blockade almost at our pleasure. He made a little gesture of qualification. You understand, I'm speaking of a blockade of the entire coast. If they amass enough ships, the Malwa could close off Supara itself. But I assume there must be other nearby places where we could land a vessel and offload cargo. A multitude of them, exclaimed Bindusara. All eyes turned toward the Sadhu. I am familiar with the Malabar coast, he explained. With the entire western coast of India, in fact. From Kerala to the Kathiawar. Bindusara turned his head eastward, as if studying the nearby shore through the walls of the cabin. The western ghats run parallel to the coast from the southernmost tip of India all the way north to the Narmada River. They form the western boundary of the Deccan. He fluttered his hands. The ghats are not tall mountains, nothing like the Himalayas. Their average height is less than 1,000 yards. Even the greatest of them, Manaimudi in Kerala, is not 3,000 yards high, but they are quite rugged. The combination of their ruggedness and low altitude means that the western shore of India boasts a huge number of small rivers instead of a few mighty ones like the Ganges and the Brahmaputra, as does the east coast.
Smuggler's terrain, grunted Ezana.
Bindusara smiled. Terrain? Say better, smuggler's paradise. Don't forget the climate, Ezana. India's west coast is the wettest part of our land. Each one of those rivers enters the sea through forests of teak and palms. There are any number of hidden and secluded coves in which a cargo could be unloaded. And the local population would be quite happy to assist in the process. Poor farmers and fishermen they are, mostly, with a great need for extra money and no love for the Malwa. Shakuntala, seeing Wasi nod, stated, You could do it then.
Without question, Empress.
The Ethiopian officer ran fingers through his mass of thick, kinky hair, eyeing Shakuntala all the while.
You want to break the siege of Deagiri by controlling all of southern Maharashtra, he speculated, using Supara as your logistics base.
The Empress nodded.
Exactly. I wouldn't think of trying it if the enemy's main army wasn't tied up in Persia.